From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite. Today on the program, Milwaukee's long history of resisting major publicly financed building projects. Then high hopes for three new developments for Milwaukee County Transit.
I think what we're going to see is that this is our best chance to increase ridership and make it more suitable for the people in our community by these upgrades.
The latest installment in the Islands of Milwaukee. And research into the state of flow involves finding ideal research subjects.
I focused on the adventure sport athletes because they have gotten better at hacking the state of flow than anybody else probably in the history of the world. So we can use them as case studies and apply this information across all domains of society.
Lake Effect comes your way next after this news update. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tike. Nice to have you listening today. The news that former Senator Herb Cole has reached an agreement to sell the NBA's Milwaukee Bucks to Mark Lazary and Wesley Edens was a shot in the arm for supporters of a new downtown basketball arena. Cole and his buyers have each agreed to kick in $100 million of their own money to help fund the proposed arena. But that optimism was quickly tempered by people who are still lukewarm or firmly opposed to any plans for public financing to play a role in building such a facility. Milwaukee Business Journal senior reporter Rich Kirchen says that's in line with years of Milwaukee economic history. His article appears in the latest issue of the newspaper, and he's been blogging about it this week as well. Rich, nice to see you. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, Mitch.
So Milwaukee has this reputation for saying no to major projects.
What's your point? No. Yeah, that was one of the fun and yet depressing aspects of reporting the story was just talking about, I don't know if you'd call it institutional or cultural reticence that goes back decades, really. The last great wave of public projects in Milwaukee was in the 1950s, you know, and that was driven by the Greater Milwaukee Committee, which got Milwaukee County Stadium built, got the freeway system started, got the Milwaukee Arena, now the U.S. Cellular Arena, built. It just seems like going back decades that the modus operandi is set up a task force or a blue ribbon panel, have them discuss forever, make a report, and then file it away, and we'll see you later.
Well, and so let's talk about the last, say, 15 or 20 years. What do you compare the arena debate to?
Well, the most obvious comparison is the debate over a new baseball stadium for the Brewers, which happened during the 1990s. Bud Selig officially had been talking about it starting in the 80s and then made an official proposal in 1992. The stadium was finally completed in 2001, but it was a huge issue around here, hotly debated. You had Governor Thompson at the time, Tommy Thompson, who supported the project but had a very Tommy Thompson way of getting support around the state. He suggested that voters up north, for example, should stick it to the people in Milwaukee, and we could pay for our own stadium.
Well, and it should be said that obviously the stadium was built, but even as the Brewers, you know, typically draw 2.5 or 3 million fans a year, there are still people who are smarting over the sales tax that that pays for part of it.
Yeah, the sales tax actually started as 0.1%. It started in advance of the stadium construction, and right now it looks like it's going to last at least until 2018. It's surprising to me that some people still resent it. It's a pretty tiny amount of money out of pocket every year for consumers. But it's more about the principle of the thing. Why are we giving? If I'm going to give my 0.1% to anything, maybe I don't like baseball. Maybe I don't think the money should go to Major League Baseball players and owners. So it seems to be more the principle of the thing, and that colors any decision going forward about public funding for a sports and entertainment arena.
Well, so that's a good comparison because we're talking about sports. But in the end, Miller Park was obviously built. There are some other comparisons you point to, things like transit issues and specifically high-speed rail and the KRM.
Yes, and those both came up around the same time a few years ago. The KRM had solid support from the business community, the Greater Milwaukee Committee, a lot of the established type of Milwaukee leadership groups who wanted to improve rail service between KRM was Kenosha, Racine, Milwaukee, but then ultimately connecting to Chicago. But the state legislature voted it down. In the case of the high-speed rail, that became just this political hot potato around the time that Scott Walker was running, and in sort of that midterm backlash election where Democrats did poorly and Republicans did well. And Governor Walker said, again, this is something that Tommy Thompson had supported back in the 90s for Wisconsin. But then when the Obama administration came along with hundreds of millions of dollars for this project, it was very unpopular with Republicans, and the governor rejected the money.
And so this is a comparison where the book is essentially closed on those. And then you also point to the site at 4th and Wisconsin, which people have been talking about redeveloping for years. And currently it is a surface level parking lot.
Yes. Well, those of us who've been around Milwaukee for a long time remember in the 80s when that site was cleared out. And the idea was that it would be a hotel or some other kind of development along Wisconsin Avenue. At that time, the convention center was not fronting on Wisconsin Avenue. It was about a block away, but now it is. And still, nothing. There have been a couple of major private development proposals at that site, but nothing has ever happened. And now the city's looking at making it sort of a pedestrian park with parking.
Well, and so is part of the issue in all of these things that especially currently arena backers have in front of them, but really anybody looking at large publicly financed projects, that the debate simply starts with no?
Yes, that's the starting point. Yeah, it I think a lot of those people say in the Association of Commerce, other civic leaders, at the press conference a couple of weeks ago where Mark Lazary and Wes Edens were introduced as the new owners of the Bucks or the prospective owners, they made an announcement, and then Mark Murata made an announcement on behalf of Herb Cole that a total of $200 million was now on the table toward a new arena. I think, you know, it was hallelujah, we've got us a new arena. But it almost seems like that somehow has generated more negative feelings from folks who don't want to put money toward a new arena, because they're saying, well, if you've got $200 million, why don't you just pay for the whole thing? Estimated cost $400 million or more.
And speaking specifically about the arena, I mean, let's look around the country. There have been 13 new NBA arenas that have opened, I think, since 1999. How do they break down in terms of public and private financing? Most of these had some fairly significant degree of public financing, right?
Yes. There was one that was only 3% public financing, and there were four that were 100% publicly financed. So that leaves a large group in the middle. And Milwaukee, let's say it came down to there was this $200 million of private money. The total cost was $500 million. Milwaukee would be about in the middle at 50%. The Association of Commerce and other arena supporters are trying to get other donors, foundations, private individuals. I talked with Mark Attanasio, the Brewers owner, who said he is interested in putting some money toward a downtown arena. So chances are there would be a higher percentage than where we're at right now.
Well, is there any way public financing can happen in some form other than a sales tax?
Yes, there are many ways. The most obvious, the most simple would be a tax incremental financing district where the city of Milwaukee would create a zone around the arena property. Depending, you know, you'd assume the arena wouldn't really provide much, if any, property tax revenue. But if there was new development, say hotels, retail, restaurants that went up around the arena site, and that was in the TIF zone, any new tax revenue would go to pay off the financing. Now there's been some talk of a super TIF, super tax incremental financing district, where you would also include any additional sales tax revenue and income tax revenue. You know, the possibility that maybe when LeBron James is in town, whatever his one day income tax is, they would go toward paying off the arena. So that's the first thing. There are other ways that the state of Wisconsin could get involved through one of its agencies.
It may be worth pointing out that as this debate gears up for its next level, Milwaukee is not alone in this issue. Just down the street, a plan to build a baseball stadium in Franklin was chewed up and spit out.
Yes, it was at The Rock. So it seems that the public is in no mood to pay for sports facilities. The supporters of an arena in Milwaukee call it an entertainment center, not a sports arena. They point out there are concerts there. There are other special events there, you know, monster truck pull, whatever, wrestling, et cetera. So it is multi-purpose. The Bucks are there, you know, if they're not in the playoffs, they're there, you know, maybe 45 dates per year. Marquette men's team plays there. The Milwaukee Admirals play there. So it's multi-purpose. On the other hand, in Chicago, they're looking at public financing for a new arena that would be used by DePaul. So, you know, there's a whole continuum.
Well, and one of the interesting aspects to this coverage, and really there's an evocative graphic you have that shows where the opposition comes from, and it's really from all sides. You have, you know, fiscal conservatives who oppose the idea of any additional tax, suburban leaders who say they don't think their community would benefit from an arena, and then you've got others who say a sales tax is fine, but it should be used to support additional items not linked to a new arena.
Right. Well, the most outspoken on that front has been Common Ground, which started a campaign almost a year ago now to demand essentially or to say that they would support a tax, but only if at least $150 million went to playgrounds and school athletic facilities in Milwaukee County. So they're saying if we're going to provide a place for the millionaire basketball players to play, we also need better facilities for our kids to play. The county board chairwoman, Dmitrievich, is saying, and some members of the Milwaukee Common Council, Bob Bauman among them, are saying, especially if this is a Milwaukee County-only tax, they want some of the money to go to transit.
Well, and you also spoke with Mayor Tom Barrett, who says he's not opposed to the idea of a sales tax. What he is opposed to is the idea that Milwaukee would go it alone.
Yeah, he's been on record with that for some time and hasn't changed his position. So,
he also said that there are examples of big public financed projects that have succeeded in his tenure. Things like the redevelopment of the Menominee Valley. Is that a valid comparison here?
Well, I don't think it's a direct comparison, but he was responding to criticism from some folks in the commercial real estate industry. Their job is to build more stuff and create more development, and they feel that the city hasn't, you know, provided enough assistance, help, et cetera. And he provided me with a list of a number of projects where the city has played a role to encourage private investment, whether it's the Menominee River Valley, the Harley Museum, and on quite an extensive list, the brewery redevelopment at the old Pabst Brewing site.
I get the sense, though, from your reporting that this culture of no is frustrating to a certain group of business leaders and others in the community.
Well, sure. It's you go to other cities and you see that they're able to build new convention centers and that there are arenas and there's other development around that stadium. Same thing. Again, as a visitor to another place, you don't always know how they paid for it or what kind of debate they had or how many years. It just the final result looks good. So, you know, we probably wouldn't have gotten the Bradley Center in Milwaukee if not for the large donation from Jane Bradley Pettit that paid for the whole thing. You know, we probably would have lost the Bucks back then. So there's just been, again, some of it is it's just a cultural thing here that people are very careful about their money.
Rick Kirchen, thanks.
Thanks, Mitch.
Rich Kirchen is senior reporter at the Milwaukee Business Journal. He's been reporting on the Milwaukee area's penchant for rejecting publicly financed projects all this week. Regardless of funding concerns, three major initiatives are underway within the Milwaukee County Transit System. We'll get an update on their progress when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. County leaders are still working on and debating over who will manage the county's transit system in the years to come. A tentative contract was awarded to a for-profit Texas company last year, but county supervisors rejected the plan, and the system remains under the operation of the nonprofit Milwaukee Transport Services, who has run MCTS for years. Meanwhile, the bus system is closing in on three major changes that will affect riders: a new fare box system, automated stop announcements, and real-time tracking of buses. That last development was launched just last week on its first route. Jacqueline Jans is Chief Communications Officer for MCTS, and she's with us in the studio now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. There's a lot of excitement going on in transit right now.
Well, and let's talk about that. The initial phase of real-time bus tracking went online just in the last week. It's on a single route only so far, correct?
Right. This is very exciting for us. Out of the three projects, I think our customers have been waiting mostly for the real-time information. And real-time means just that, that they'll be able to see in real-time where their bus is at any time, which really helps on our reliability and convenience. So we expect it's going to increase ridership and increase ease for our current riders.
Is there a certain level of accountability that also fosters that not only are riders able to track it, but as the company managing the buses, you're able to look at where they are at any given time?
Currently, we do monitoring through our GPS system. It's a little bit different than real time, because the way real time works is it's of the timing of the bus stop. But when you look at it, it's going to say under 2 minutes, going to say approaching the stop. Now, if under those 2 minutes there happens to be a traffic jam, it's going to say approaching that stop for a while longer. So we probably won't be using it the same way our customers will be using it. We'll continue tracking our on time through our other GPS network.
Well, and so how is the data going to be offered, or is already being offered to riders?
Sure. We started this out, like you said, with one route, with Route 21. And the reason that we did this, one, is we want to test it. We want to hear back from our customers how it's working. But we also knew there was a lot of excitement. So if we waited the few months that it takes to get all the buses online, we know we'd hear from our customers saying, we want to see it now. So we launched it with the one route, and we wanted to provide as much access as possible. So whether you have a smartphone or don't have a smartphone, you can access it. Whether you have computer access or don't, you can use the system. So I'll walk through those.
Sure.
those ways. So first off, the easiest way is online. If you go to our website, you'll see a link to real time, and from there you can access a map showing the buses along Route 21, and you can actually watch them travel around the road if you have nothing else to do. And then you could also see a table that will show you how many minutes the bus is approaching to your bus stop. But you can also do this by your phone, in which you have we have a mobile website, so it's easy to access, and we have a text-only area. Eventually, there will be an app that Clever Devices is working on for us, so we'll make sure to let people know when that app is ready. But then you can also text information, so you can text your bus stop and get the next buses that are arriving and how long they'll be arriving to your stop, or you can call our phone system. But with texting and phone, we like to tell people to make sure that they have to know their bus stop ID number to be able to use those features. So it's either 1 to 5 digits, and there's multiple places that you can find those bus ID numbers. I can tell you about one is at the bus stop sign. We're installing those right now, but over 5,000 bus stops. It's taking us. It's going to take us a little while to get them out at every single bus stop. But also on our schedules, you can look on the online feature, or you can call us, and we'll make sure to get to your bus stop number.
What have been the challenges in getting this whole system into place?
Well, you know, we are a nonprofit company, and our mission, as you can guess, is to make sure people get to where they need to go. But also over the last 12 years, we've had funding issues. So and we've been trying to upgrade the system, not just the real time, but fare boxes and a stop announcement system and so forth. So we have a lot on our plate. We're very small administration staff. So and but the people there are dedicated. We so want to move transit ahead, so we've kept pushing these projects. That's why all three of them are happening at the same time, because we're able to get the funding, get the technology updated at transit so that we can offer it. And we're not going to slow it down just because it's too much work to do. We're going to offer all three at once.
Well, and so what is the time frame for the full rollout of real time?
So the most important thing, and I know everybody wants to know, when exactly is it going to happen? And what our commitment is that we have the least many issues as possible.
I imagine bad data would be worse than no data at all.
Correct. And we want to test it. And we've all seen in the past year of people launching websites and all sorts of things that did not go well because they didn't test at all or they didn't test long enough. So our commitment is to continue the testing. But with transit, we have to test kind of out there too, because our public has to use it to let us know if it's working correctly. So unfortunately, I'm not going to say, you know, in 1 week everything is available,
right?
Because what we're doing is we're watching it through the testing, and as soon as we're confident that it's working well, that's when it's going to go out.
Is the thought that you'll scale from the single route to all the routes, or are you going to roll them out? Okay, we have the 21 online, let's put the 31 and the 30 online next.
So what's interesting is that our stop announcement system, which I'm very excited about. I don't know how many other people are excited about, but it is great for especially for people with disabilities that they can hear their stops announced. It's clear, and there's also visuals. So if you have hearing or visual disabilities, it's really going to help. And people that are new to our city, so that project is done by Clever Devices, and so is the real time. Those two are connected together, so we've been able to create some efficiency. So as soon as the routes are checked for the stop announcement system and verified working, we can push them out onto real time. So what we're going to do now is work with one of our stations, our Fond du Lac station. A lot of people know that we have three stations. We're going to work on those routes from Fond du Lac. We're going to equip and get the stop announcement system rolling. As soon as you start seeing those working on that, then you'll know the next step will be to rolling out real time. So we're looking at the next couple weeks. We'll be able to have we're hoping to have more stop announcement and more real time out there.
And stop announcement has been under testing for a while. I mean, I as a bus rider myself, I remember actually hearing the stop announcements. Gosh, it's probably been 8 or 9 months ago.
I can't remember, recall exactly when the stop announce system was installed on all the buses, but we started testing, and that we had to be very careful in. We have a lot of bus stops on certain routes, so the timing of when someone announced it and when they announced the next one, there was a lot to that. So we are working out the bugs on that. Route 21 and Route 80 do have the stop announcement systems running okay, and we have a tone now, and we have everything recorded of the bus stops and the names and so forth. So we feel confident about that, and we can't wait to start launching the other routes.
Well, and does this happen? I mean, this is an automated system, correct? The bus driver doesn't have to trigger the next stop announcement. I assume it's integrated with GPS so that the system knows where on the route it is.
Right, and there's all sorts of little tweaks that we have to do. What if the route is detoured, and how do you handle that? There's often small detours throughout the day over the county, and so we have to tell the system what to do. So obviously, we have to disable the system if it starts going off route. But that is, we have to have the timing down exactly right with those, and that takes a bit of testing. We actually have to go out on the streets and test them and ride routes. routes and drive routes over and over again to make sure that it's working appropriately.
So those are two key projects. The other major change that will affect a lot of people is the new fare boxes. First off, just simply, what is the status of that project?
Sure. With our new fare system, and it's not just a fare box, it's a whole new system from the top bottom. And Scheidt and Bachmann built the system for us and is implementing it for us. So all buses right now have the new fare boxes. And we're using them in the cash-only area, which that is being tested right now, how the cash is being taken. It is going to be a slower process than before because this is a smart fare box in that it is recording and tracking every single bill or coin that's going in there. That's not what we had before. Before, you could just stuff the fare right. box with whatever and we count it at the end. So now it's a much different system. So we're in the testing phase of that, but also exciting is that we are testing smart cards now in which we have a pilot group of commuter value program participants that are going to be testing out the fare boxes just to see how they're working, if they're working correctly, if we have to make any changes and so forth.
These are smart cards that you basically just touch the card to the box and it records the fare.
Right. It's there's an orange target on the fare boxes, and we ask you to touch it or place it and give it a second to read the card. It does go quickly, but if you go too quickly, it won't have chance to read it. And then it will record your fare take or in the future with the – not with the CVP, but with the M-card users, the MCTS M-cards, they will actually be able to have two choices of fares, either pass or a deduct value.
Why are they necessary? What was wrong with regular old money?
Well, this the electronic fare boxes are going to give us a huge improvement. Right now we're doing estimates of data of who's riding and when's riding because we have no way to count individual passengers. With this new fare system, we'll know exactly who's riding and at what time. So we'll be able to count the passengers. It'll help us monitor the system of overloading or if there's not as much riding. If you think about how many routes we have 59 routes going all across Milwaukee County. We continually monitor them. But to be able to monitor them effectively, we really need information on every single route all the time so that we can look at this and be able to tweak the system to the best serve the community.
What about riders who only occasionally use the bus system? Is cash still going to work?
Yep, cash will always work. We're making sure that's available for individuals. But also individuals that only ride, they can fill up their M card with, say, $10, and it will always be good. And whenever they want to use it, they'll be able to tap it. It will be much easier to use an M card. So we're really encouraging people to switch over from using cash, although we always will accept cash.
Where are the M cards going to be available?
Similar to how we sell tickets and passes today. So they'll be at sales outlets. That information is still coming. We're still working on soliciting individuals to sell them. But an added convenience will be that they're located online, that you can purchase it online so your card can be updated, which will be another great convenience for our customers.
Is this going to affect fares at all? I mean, to use an analogy here, people driving, say, toll roads in Illinois and onto the East Coast can use cash to go through the toll booth, but if they use an Easy Pass, the toll is cheaper.
Right. Our fares are staying the same. That was voted through in the last budget. So the fares are the same, but you do get a discount, just like you do now with passes and tickets. You get a discount off a cash fare. Well, using the MCTS M card in the future, you'll be able to get a discount. So it is an advantage to use the M card.
Well, and along those lines, there are some who would probably ask why money is being spent on technology like this rather than on expanding routes or lowering fares or simply buying more new buses.
Sure. Actually, our fare boxes are going on to 30 years old, about 27 years old right now. And the amount of problems that we have with them, just trying to repair them, it takes a lot of money and a lot of individuals to keep those running. So we have to move to a new fare system. This will actually provide greater convenience, and it will be a better system for for us overall, and I think it will be able to save us money in the end in that we'll be able to have the data and so forth, be able to move into this great electronic age here.
Well, and for the – I mean there are other skeptics out there, and hear me out on this question who are saying that, you know, they're skeptical of the changes and say they're only happening as the future management of the bus system is still up in the air. How long have these plans been in progress, and why are all three of them coming together now as they are?
Well, with any transit system, you have to monitor and keep the system updated as you move along. And with these projects, and our customers know, we've been talking about them since we started looking at them, and it's been for years. One of the major ones that we had to do was our GPS system. Our GPS system was 20 years old. When we first launched our AVL, it's called an AVL dispatch system, we were one of the first in the country to have this great system. But it also meant that we didn't we weren't able to put funds towards increasing or updating that GPS system because we were having funding issues. So it would be great if we could keep everything rolling and moving and at the level that we're at, but we're not going to be able to do that. If you think of technology, 20 years old, I know some people over there just be shocked, especially our fare boxes of 27-year-olds. They literally don't work. They're not working anymore. So at this point, because of the limited funds that we've had and resources, we do the best to keep pushing us ahead. But yes, we've been working on this for quite a while in the planning stages of, one, being able to purchase it. And then once you're able to get the funding, because the funds aren't just sitting there for us, you have to look on the planning side and plan what's the best for the community. And then you have to implement it and test it. And I just think we're very happy to be here. And I think what we're going to see is that this is our best chance to increase ridership and make it more suitable for the people in our community by these upgrades.
Jackie Janz, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Jacqueline Janz is Chief Communications Officer for the Milwaukee County Transit System. Real-time bus tracking went into effect on one route last week, the number 21, with plans to scale the service up to the rest of the system in the weeks and months to come. One last break, and then, do you go with the flow? Our next guest has been studying flow, that almost perfectly balanced place we sometimes get into when everything seems to work pretty effortlessly. We'll hear about the latest flow research next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Time now for our weekly series, The Islands of Milwaukee.
Welcome to the Islands of Milwaukee.
This is Maureen Towey from the Islands of Milwaukee. As I mentioned last week, many of our questions of the day are leading into longer conversations, and some of these conversations are starting to grow into more creative expressions. Angie is a woman living in the St. Francis area who has been reliably answering our questions every week, so we decided to pay her a visit. Angie is in a wheelchair and described having some difficulty getting around the city. We asked her, is there an intersection you wish you could cross but feel it is too dangerous? And in response, she wrote us a poem.
A stroker crossing over. 1 foot out, you hear a rumble and a roar. You don't want to be a blob of gore, so 1 foot back for the speed you lack. 1 foot out and the other foot out. You hear a roar, oh, what a bore. You look to the right, the traffic is coming. Oh, no, not again. You move back with all your might. You look to the left, more traffic is coming. You look all around, hoping to cross over to the park before dark. This would be such a lark.
Angie's poem reflects a legitimate concern of lots of seniors in Milwaukee that it can be difficult and dangerous to cross some intersections on foot. In response, we're working with UWM students to stage a series of crossings in May. You can think of them like mini parades at busy intersections. We're hoping that our crossings will serve as a vibrant reminder that these seniors are worth stopping for. If you or someone you know would like to answer a question of the day, call our Islands line or visit our website. We consider each answered question to be a little collaboration that helps us to grow into a more connected community. Thanks for listening.
These crossings are happening this week. Look for them on May 1st from 2 to 4 at KK Logan and Russell, May 2nd from 9 to 11 at St. Francis and KK, and from 2 to 4 on that day at Packard and Ramsey. You can participate in the Islands of Milwaukee project by calling the Islands hotline at 414-678-1653 or by visiting islandsofmilwaukee.org. People in all walks of life experience it, that feeling when you're so engrossed in something that everything else seems to melt away. You're not aware of time passing and only vaguely aware of your surroundings. It's a phenomenon often referred to as flow, and it's been studied for some time. But only comparatively recently have researchers begun to understand what's really happening in the bodies of people in the state of flow. Stephen Kotler looked closely at flow through the lens of extreme athletes, people like big wave surfers and base jumpers. Kotler is a UW-Madison graduate, co-founder of the Flow Genome Project, and the author of the recent book, The Rise of Superman, Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. And Kotler says the research into flow has implications that go well beyond adventure sports. We reached him on the line from New Mexico, and he offered a working definition of the phenomenon.
Flow refers to an optimal state of consciousness where we feel our best and we perform our best. And most people have some experience with this state. Flow refers to those moments of total absorption where our focus becomes so intense that everything else falls away. Action and awareness start to merge. Sense of self, self-consciousness disappear. Time dilates, so sometimes it slows down. You get that freeze frame effect as if you've been in a car crash. Or it speeds up and 5 hours will pass by in 5 minutes. And throughout, all aspects of performance, mental and physical, go through the roof.
And you use sort of adventure sports as a focus for this book. But flow, as you imply, can take place in many different things that we're doing.
Absolutely. There are billions of different on-ramps into flow. And I focused on the adventure sport athletes because they have gotten better at hacking the state of flow for some reasons that we can get into if you want than anybody else probably in the history of the world. So we can use them as case studies and apply this information across all domains in society. But we know flow is fundamental everywhere. For example, McKinsey just did a 10-year study. They found top executives are 5 times more productive in flow than out of flow.
Flow is something that's been known about for a long time, but has our understanding of flow always been grounded in science?
Well, our contemporary understanding of flow, the research on flow actually goes back about 150 years, and some of the kind of foundational work that was done in fields like cognitive neuroscience or experimental psychology were actually done on flow. William James talked about flow. We had different terminology. Abraham Maslow talked about flow. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi in the 70s actually gave the state its name. But what has happened since then and what's so amazing is there's been a revolution in neuroscience. So for the very first time in 150 years, in the past 15 years, and really in the past 5, we have been able to look under the hood. And we now understand the neurobiology of what's creating this experience, which is fantastic because if we understand what's creating it, we now know how to get more of it.
What have the technological developments been that have allowed us to get under the hood, if you will?
Well, 3 different areas, right? If you're talking about the neuroscience of anything, you want to know 3 things. You want to know neuroanatomy, which is where something in the brain is taking place, and fMRI has given us a look into that. You want to understand neuroelectricity and neurochemistry, which are the 2 ways the brain talks to itself. Neuroelectricity, that's EEG work. Now, that's been around for a very long time. Used to be that you had to sit absolutely still and not move and not blink and not yawn to get an accurate EEG reading. Our algorithms have just gotten so good that we've been able to filter out this noise so we can now have people moving around and figure out what their brain is doing. So it's given us a much deeper window to the brain. And the last bit is neurochemistry. And that's really a measuring problem. And we haven't been able to measure neurochemicals in the brain, not even in the body very well, until really the last 10 to 15 years.
How is flow manifesting itself in someone like an adventure athlete, whether it's a big wave surfer or an aerial skier or someone who's doing the kinds of mountaineering that seemed impossible once?
What you have to understand is how flow amplifies performance, and it does it in a lot of different ways. We just kind of covered some of the neuroscience behind it. But let's just start with the neurochemistry for a second. We now know that flow is a cocktail of kind of five of the most potent neurochemicals the brain can produce: dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, andamine, and endorphins. Dopamine and norepinephrine are focusing chemicals. They help drive attention into the now. They help us take in more information per second and process more deeply. They also speed up muscle reaction times in various ways. And most importantly, they lower signal-to-noise ratios in the brain, which is a fancy way of saying they up our pattern recognition abilities. Pattern recognition is a really kind of fundamental property of the brain. It's the ability to link ideas together. So fundamental, all forms of creativity, critical thinking, any kinds of high-speed decision-making, you're going to want really fast pattern recognition. Anandamide does something else. It kills pain a little bit, but it also expands the database searched by the pattern recognition system to heighten creativity, which happens in flow all the time. The reason creativity goes through the roof is because not only do you have this upping of pattern recognition, our ability to link ideas together, but anandamide allows us to move beyond kind of the logical and the linear. And that's where you're getting creative breakthroughs.
Well, and one of the things that was interesting to read about was the parts of the brain that are acting most when this kind of pattern recognition is going on. It's almost reversed from what we might have intuited before. The parts of the brain that we might have thought would be quiet are active and vice versa.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. You know, it's a mistaken assumption, but they call it the 10% brain myth, this idea that we only use 10% of our brain. And there was a downstream corollary from that, which is that optimal performance must be us using 100% of our brain at all times. And this idea actually was a misquote of William James, but it came from Dale Carnegie. But it kind of became this mainstay of the self-help movement. Turns out it's entirely backwards. Flow is caused by what's called transient hypofrontality. Transient hypofrontality means the temporary deactivation of the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that houses most of our higher cognitive function. This is the part kind of right behind your forehead. In flow, major portions of the prefrontal cortex are shutting down. So, for example, why does time pass so strangely in flow? Time is actually calculated all over the prefrontal cortex. Parts of it start to wink out. You can no longer separate past from present from future. Another thing that happens is a portion of our brain called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. That's impulse control and self-monitoring. Self-monitoring is your inner critic, that kind of nagging, defeatist voice that's always in your head. It shuts up in flow. It goes away. Most of our higher cognitive functions are being traded out for the faster and more efficient subconscious processing.
If that's what's going on in the brain of someone who is experiencing flow, what do we know about how athletes are able to put themselves into a position where they can tap into flow?
What we now know is there are 17 different flow triggers. These are preconditions that lead to more flow. What action adventure sport athletes have done is they have literally built their lives around these triggers. Now, a lot of these triggers are very kind of fundamental in action adventure sports. A lot of them have nothing to do with action adventure sports, but they show up there. So to give you a couple of examples, there are 3 environmental triggers, 3 psychological triggers, 10 social triggers, and 1 creative trigger. Let's just talk about the psychological triggers. One of the simplest ones is actually known as clear goals. So the idea here is flow follows focus. So all of these triggers, every one of them, are ways of driving attention into the now. So when we set clear goals, we always know what we're doing, and we always know what to do next. So we don't have to wonder. We don't have to pull our attention out of the moment. We can stay focused where we are and thus have an easier time accessing flow. Another one of the psychological triggers is immediate feedback. When there's no gap between cause and effect, we know what to do next. So action adventure sports sort of happens automatically. If you're skiing a big couloir and you don't set your edge properly, you're going to end up on a face-first slide to the bottom. It's immediate feedback. We see this in business environments. For example, in medicine, surgeons turn out to be the only class of doctors that get better the longer they are out of medical school. Everybody else, their skills decline. Why is this? Surgeons get immediate feedback. They screw up, the patient dies on the table. It's immediate feedback. Radiologists, they may read a radiological screen, pass it on to the next guy, next gal, and they want to know about the outcome for 6 months, if at all. So there's a big gap between cause and effect. When feedback is immediate, again, it keeps attention focused in the now. This goes on and on. There are 17 of these various triggers. Action adventure sport athletes have built their lives around them. But anybody, pretty much anybody, can do the same.
Is it oversimplifying things to say that these are the kinds of decisions that if you stop to think about them, you're already lost?
Well, in flow, that is what happens. Why do we call the experience flow? It's because every decision, every action leads seamlessly, fluidly to the next. Flow is as close to picture-perfect decision-making as we can get. So this isn't to say that you can't stop and think about things in flow, but you can pull yourself out of the state fairly quickly that way.
You write that these athletes aren't adrenaline junkies. In fact, there may be the opposite. So what is the explanation for the rush that's also involved while they're in this state of flow?
First of all, you have to understand it contextually. For it to be flowy, for you to be able to go from one idea to the next, to the next, to the next, to get that very rapid decision-making, you can't get hung up. You need as many options as possible when making decisions. So flow is a choices wide open thing. The fight or flight response, the adrenaline response, is the exact opposite. There are options narrowed to three: fight, flight, or flee. You can do three things instead of anything's possible. So it is the exact opposite. What's happening differently is in the fight or flight response, we often say that athletes have to move through the fight or flight response to get into flow. It's because the front end of the flow state and the front end of the flight or flight response are very similar. You get a rising of cortisol, norepinephrine, adrenaline. These are stress hormones and focusing chemicals. And what happens in flow is they go to a certain level, and then there is a global release of nitric oxide that kind of floats these chemicals out of your system and replaces them with a bunch of other neurochemicals. That doesn't happen in the flight or flight response. You just get those front-end chemicals rising up so you can't switch over into the flow state.
I was amazed to read that many of these athletes, some of the base jumpers and some of the people who ski off cliffs essentially, are actually kind of terrified of heights.
Yeah, it's not as uncommon as you think. You have to understand what people don't see. You see Laird Hamilton on a 100-foot wave or a 50-foot wave, and you think, oh my God, I could never do that. That's insane. But what you forget is that Laird Hamilton basically grew up in Hawaii. He was being rescued by lifeguards at Pipeline every 4 or 5 days when he was a little kid. The lifeguards got so pissed off, they told his father to lock him up while his father went surfing. But, you know, there were years of 3-foot waves, 4-foot waves, 5-foot waves, 6-foot waves, 7-foot waves, pushing up what we call the challenge skills ratio. This is another flow trigger. Flow shows up when the challenge slightly exceeds your skill level and when you're stretching but not snapping, basically. So that's sort of how you ride the fight or flight response into the flow state. But Laird slowly upped this challenge skills ratio day after day, week after week, month after month. We see a video of Laird on the Millennium Wave or something like that, and, you know, it looks like the most incredible thing you've ever seen, and you ask them about it, and it's another day at the office for them.
What do we still not know about flow that we need to learn next, do you think?
Oh, my God, the list is so long. So what we did in the 20th century is we got great at understanding the psychology of flow. We understand that a bunch of these triggers that are psychological, and we have described the state very well, and we've really analyzed it. We have just started to plumb the neurobiology of the state. A lot of these things, for example, I mentioned a bunch of neurochemicals, we're not exactly certain the order that cascade. We've got some research on this, not enough. The physiology of flow, what happens in the body, is pretty much a black hole at this point. But again, we have some inklings, but what really needs to happen is, and this is kind of the work that we're doing at the Flow Genome Project, which is the organization that I co-founded to kind of advance flow science. So we're trying to map the psychology onto the neurobiology, onto the physiology, so we can have basically a heat map of flow. We don't think there's going to be exact coordinates. Everybody's going to differ. But if we have this heat map, we should be able to figure out exactly what's the easiest way for everybody to get into flow and what's the fastest, most reliable way to do it.
Let's say you're not an adventure athlete and you're not even necessarily a business leader. What is the takeaway for the average person on this? How do you see flow impacting that kind of stuff that people do that on its face doesn't seem to have a big application for flow, but probably does?
One of the things we know about flow is the neurochemicals that show up in flow massively jack up the immune system, and they sort of reset the nervous system. So they kind of filter out these stress hormones and they really amplify the immune system. So there's a tremendous healing benefit to flow, first of all. But let's go back to your question and why should the average person care about it? And I always say it comes down to three things: motivation, creativity, and learning. These neurochemicals that show up in flow are the most addictive chemicals on earth. Of course, psychologists don't like to use the word addictive, so they call flow the source code of intrinsic motivation. It means that once something starts producing flow, we'll go extraordinarily far out of our ways to get more of it and more of it and more of it. But the difference between flow and other addictions is because flow requires challenge, skills, and learning. It is an addiction that leads us into the future rather than backwards. So who doesn't need more motivation?
Were you able to get yourself into a state of flow as you wrote a book about getting into the state of flow?
Sometimes. You have to really understand the kind of challenge skills balance and the kind of the gap between it and what's perfect for each person. When I started writing the book, my publisher got so excited. They took what was going to be a 14-month deadline and asked me to do it in 7 months. So the challenge level, right off, I was like a chapter and a half into the book. I had just gotten a good pace, and all of a sudden the challenge level went through the roof. You know, I will tell you, my book, A Small Furry Prayer, I literally wrote the entire book in a flow state in almost a 3-week sitting. There was a lot of writer's block that led up to that, but once it started coming out of me, you know, it literally, the whole book showed up in 3 weeks and turned it in.
Well, Stephen Kotler, it's a really fascinating read, and I thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen Kotler is author of The Rise of Superman, Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. He's a UW-Madison graduate and now lives in New Mexico, where he is co-founder of the Flow Genome Project and the Rancho de Chihuahua Dog Sanctuary. Our interview first aired in March. That's Tuesday's edition of Lake Effect. In the works for tomorrow's show, more on the Crossings Project within the islands of Milwaukee, and what are the city's must-eats? I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much again for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh air is next. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.